Good evening and welcome. My name is Michelle Call. I use she, her, and hers pronouns, and I'm the executive director of the Gala Pride and Diversity Center. As we celebrate National Coming Out Day, we welcome our opening speaker, California State Assembly member Evan Lowe, who is currently serving in District 28. I was fortunate to hear him speak for an Equality California event, and his story of service and his deep understanding of the needs of not only LGBTQ plus folks, but his whole community inspired me so much that I wanted you to hear from him today. At the age of 31, Assemblymember Lowe became the youngest Asian American legislator to have been elected to the Assembly in state history. A Bay Area native, Evan Lowe's work within the community and deep knowledge of issues local residents faced led him to run for Campbell City Council in 2006 when he was just 23 years old. Assemblymember Lowe has introduced legislation to protect the LGBTQ plus community, tackle the housing crisis, increase voter participation in elections, and strengthen consumer protections. And I can't imagine a better role model for my child and the queer youth on the Central Coast. Over to California Assemblymember Evan Lowe.
Thank you so very much, Michelle. I appreciate and am entirely grateful for the service that you do each and every day for our community and for those specifically in need. And similarly, happy National Coming Out Day to you as well. I know that we all have our unique stories to tell. And greetings to all of you. What a wonderful opportunity to speak with you and to also participate in our democratic process. I know that in the very near future, you'll be hearing in partnership with the League of Women Voters from other additional public servants answering the call to service. And it's an exciting time, most certainly. But as we have an opportunity then today to speak about the reference to the meaning of National Coming Out Day, I oftentimes hear this question, well, why is it important? Do we not have it made in California? But if we don't remember our history, we will see much of it repeated. So let's take an opportunity just to think about the state of California and where we are. And my own personal experiences. I now have the pleasure of serving for about 15 years in public service, not quite as long as your next state senator, John Laird, my dear friend, but getting my start. But when I was 21 years old, I ran for office. There wasn't much time to understand my own identity growing up as a teenager in San Jose. We didn't have this notion of the internet where you could see role models of NBA players, movie stars, individuals that you looked up to that was a sense of pride. And instead, we didn't learn about our own identity in school. We didn't talk about it at home. And what you saw on TV was just only a very small segment of the community. And so as a young boy, I wandered around aimlessly. I think we can all share with some of those experiences, but I wandered around aimlessly at a Barnes and Noble. And for the younger individuals who might be viewing now, that is a bookstore. We still might have a few of those still around. But I would wander around aimlessly at the gay and lesbian section, pretending I was lost, scurrying through books and trying to find out what it meant. Was I different? How do I make sense of this? And again, I didn't learn about this in school. We didn't have the sex education yet in our textbooks. That was later on, and much in large part due to our amazing public servants and elected officials. And that's why, by the way, representation matters. That's why it matters when you have openly LGBTQ members of the legislature and in public office serving in these institutions so that we can demonstrate the best of our abilities, the tapestry of our talent in the state of California, and recognizing that there are all kinds of people in our society. So as I ran for office, I would knock on the doors and have people say all kinds of things to me. But again, as a 21-year-old individual, I can only assume what some of those people would say, very incredulous. But they would say, as I would knock on doors, some residents would say things like, wow, you speak English so good. And of course, my response was, you mean I speak English well. I am a fourth generation Californian speaking more Spanish than I do Chinese. but for some reason, I'm seen as a perpetual foreigner. And or running for office, there was a time to which individuals and some voters would do a whisper campaign and say, is it going to bring the San Francisco gay agenda to the city of Campbell based in Silicon Valley? Fast forward to a few years later, I was successful in serving in city council and eventually as mayor. But serving in that capacity came with some unique challenges. We had this proposition referenced as Proposition 8, which verbatim, Proposition 8 in 2008, for those of you who might remember our dark history, Proposition 8 before the California electorate was such that, do you wish to eliminate the rights of same-sex couples to marry? Verbatim, eliminating the rights of same-sex couples to marry. Just boggles my mind thinking that today, in which before the California electorate, we'd say eliminate the rights of anyone. Yet in 2008, that passed. But as mayor for that city of Campbell, I found myself in a unique position to which I could officiate weddings later on. We've had a crazy back and forth history of marriage equality with the court decisions and local jurisdictions. But I could officiate a wedding, but I couldn't get married myself, which was that I had, as a public official, the opportunity to officiate wedding marriages. And I was asked by a number of heterosexual couples, friends, members of the public to officiate a wedding. But I, as a gay man, could not get married myself. I would welcome the Boy Scouts, many of them who needed to earn their merit badges to meet with the mayor. And one of the little boys asked, Mr. Mayor, were you also in Boy Scouts? Is that how you became mayor? And of course, members of our community, gay boys, were not allowed to be part of the Boy Scouts. So my response was, just go ask your parents. During this time, I also received a letter, an invitation from the Red Cross. The Red Cross would send these letters of invitation to mayors in Northern California. They referenced it as the blood challenge during the summer times was that many people were away vacationing, and so there was a blood shortage. So they called it the Mayor's Blood Challenge. And the letter was asking me, as mayor for the city of Campbell, to host a blood drive. And I must admit, I felt a deep punch in the stomach when I read that letter. The letter asked me to host a blood drive, to which, as a gay man, there was a FDA ban on gay men donating blood that was instituted in 1983, the year I was born. So I was left with this conundrum. City policies do not allow for any type of discrimination or hosting any organizations that would discriminate, that including that of sexual orientation. But do I host a blood drive? But I could host a blood drive, but could not donate blood at my own drive. I eventually did host a blood drive and tried to donate blood myself to draw attention to this issue of discrimination, even though all of the blood banks were in support of this repeal of the lifetime ban on gay men donating blood. These are the challenges that we've had, but that's just within a small period of time. Again, I stand on the shoulders of people who have come before me. And in fact, when I ran for office, I sought out some other role models at the local level. And that, of course, a common name that you might be familiar with, and that is of John Laird. And I sought out his guidance, to which they were unique challenges even before that time. But I mentioned this again as we talk about National Coming Out Day and recognizing our obligation, our commitment to be present, that we are stronger together, that we must demonstrate unconditional allyship in this. As I said, that we all have a unique obligation to be in support of all that matters. I, as a man, do not have a uterus, but that does not mean that I do not stand up for the rights of women to choose for themselves. I am an American citizen, fourth generation Californian, but I still will go to the airports during the Muslim ban and protest in solidarity. I will be at the Black Lives Matter. I will be out and about for the March of Our Lives. March for Our Lives. which was and is a student-led and run effort across the nation of young people marching on the streets, demanding justice and accountability to get firearms out of schools and to support sensible firearm legislation. You've seen the Sunrise Movement of young people in their teens going out and marching and talking about the focus of environmental justice, that it is Groundhog's Day, to which we've seen 5 consecutive years of record global temperatures. So how do we not recognize that all of these issues will have a direct impact on us? Or that our society, when we talk about the issues facing younger people, that we are setting them up for failure, not for success, with this social contract, which is that of how do you possibly afford to live in your communities given the cost of rent and housing? So that's why it is critical that we engage our community, and that politics and democracy oftentimes is seen as a nasty word. We don't like to talk about politics. They're nasty, they're corrupt, and they're in it for themselves. And yet at the same time, you see such low voter participation. Did you know that in the primary election in 2014 in the state of California, the primary turnout statewide of the voter turnout was in the 20 percentile? That's right. You heard that correctly. In the state of California, in the primary election in 2014, it was in the 20%. 20%, 20 some odd percent. Now, how are we going to possibly say we want to see the change that we demand if we don't even participate? And that's why I'm so thrilled and delighted to see such partnerships from the LGBTQ community, along with other partners in supporting our fragile democracy of the League of Women Voters. So I hope that we'll continually think about the obligations that we have as active citizens and thinking about what the barriers to entry might be. That yes, politics sometimes is nasty, sometimes it is polarizing, but at the same time, we can fight for what we believe in and also participate. Let me end with a story also about engagement. Yes, we are in a democracy. I fervently disagree with my mother. In fact, I was eating dinner with her the other day in which we're going over our ballots. And we disagreed pretty significantly on the ballot proposition. But at the end of the day, I still gave her a hug, a distanced air hug, and a distanced kiss, air kiss, because we still love each other. But we disagree fundamentally on these issues. Why should it be any different? There is a proposition that you have before you called Proposition 18. And that proposition before you would be to allow those who turn 18 years old to vote in primary elections. There are some that are 17 and a half years old at the primary elections that are not eligible to vote in a primary election. And by the time they are 18 at the general election, they will be eligible to cast that general election vote. But there's a window of time that does not allow young people to vote. So this measure, should it pass, would allow those who are 17 and a half to vote in primary elections as an opportunity to instill a great sense of civic engagement and voting at a young age. Imagine candidates, politicians going to high school campuses in which there's an eligible voting pool to have town halls talking specifically about the issues facing young people as they are getting into the real world. But I referenced Proposition 18 because that was an effort that I, amongst a number of other colleagues, debated in the legislature and had some difficulty passing to get before the electorate, but it received bipartisan support. This was a bill that I co-authored, but I say this because I intentionally attempted to get bipartisan support. There was a gentleman then, an assembly member, as I was trying to get votes for this bill to get before the electorate. It was referenced as Assembly Constitutional Amendment 4, and it was to put this on the ballot. But I went to different members of the legislature to try to get their support. And on the surface, Republicans are going to say, no, we don't want to support lowering the voting age because we think this is a ploy to get Democrats to vote, to increase the capacity for Democrats to vote. And I said, I sought out a fellow colleague, a Republican. His name is Randy Vopel. He's in his 70s, ultra conservative from Santee, Vietnam veteran. So I said to him, Randy, I'd like to talk to you about this legislation to lower the voting age, but can I meet you in your district? And he said, sure. So I flew down and met with him in Santee. And we had a great discussion about these issues at his favorite burger joint. And of course, he was the town favorite. All these little kids were coming up to him, remembering him when he was mayor at Little League. So I talked to him about these issues. This was about a Thursday at 2 o'clock. Then he says to me after, do you want to go to my favorite redneck dive bar? And this is in Santee at Thursday at 2 o'clock PM. So I said, okay, I have a few moments. I'll go with you. I don't really drink. And we arrived at this redneck dive bar, and outside there were a number of trucks with NRA stickers, National Rifle Association stickers. And he just said, Evan, before you go in, just don't talk too much about being a Democrat. So I said, okay, here we go. So we go into the bar and he says, hello, everyone. There may be about 20 people in the room. And he said, meet my friend, my young gay Asian American friend from the Bay Area. And I just go, oh my gosh, this is going to be a tough one. But fast forward, we broke bread, had some great camaraderie. The next week we voted on this piece of legislation, and I didn't know what Assemblymember Vopel was going to do. But when we were debating the topic, he put up his microphone and he said, I'm speaking in support, in favor of Mr. Lowe's bill to lower the voting age against the Republican recommendation. But he said so because he said, I know Mr. Lowe. We are polar opposites on our ideology, but I understand his intent. His intentions are good, which is to increase participation. And when I was in Vietnam, I saw members of my platoon dying for their country at 17 years old. If you can die for your country, you should be able to vote. I urge an aye for this bill. And in fact, we have an incredible relationship, and we couldn't be polar opposites on paper, in person, on ideology, on votes. But again, I just share that sort of long-winded story to share with you, especially on National Coming Out Day, is be proud, be out, be proud, and be authentic. And let us try, especially right now, to find commonality with people who we might not necessarily agree with. And we can debate issues, but let us at least attempt to recognize the basic humanity of each other, that we are more in common. We have much more in common. We are much more similar than we have differences. So again, as we think about National Coming Out Day, as we think about these 23 days before this election, I am hopeful that we will take a look at instilling a sense of being active citizens. What can we do each and every day to be invested in each other's shared success? What am I doing each and every day to help society and help those in need? Again, I'm so thankful for this opportunity and time. You have an incredible amount of talent, and that of, I see you have approximately 8 or so candidates running for 2 seats for local city council, and you have an amazing, amazing lifelong public servant in John Laird, my dear friend. So thank you very much for having me, and I look forward to the continued opportunity to partner with you ahead of us. Thank you again.
California Assemblymember Evan Lowe, thank you so much for your time and your wisdom. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay, so we are going to take a 10-minute break now while we get set up for our forum, and we'll start the forum at 6 p.m. sharp.
Hi, Merrily. It's Jan.
How are you, Jan?
I'm good. I just want to say hi. We have a 10-minute break, and so I just want to say hi to you. It's so good to see you.
Wonderful. It's very nice to have you running.
Just to be clear, we're still streaming, okay?
You are?
Sorry.
During this 10 minutes?
Okay. Sorry. Oops.
Wow, 10 minutes is a lot longer than I thought it was. Could I ask, please, for the council candidates to go ahead and turn on your videos so that we can see you? And now the Gala Pride and Diversity Center would like to welcome you to our Slow City Candidates for Council Candidates Forum, moderated by the League of Women Voters. In 2020, the League is celebrating 100 years of organization and action, narrowing the gender gap when it comes to giving every US citizen the right to vote. And we thank you for your service. We would like to thank the candidates for turning out to speak, not only to LGBTQ plus voters, but everyone who needs to hear where you stand before filling out their ballots. Over to the fabulous ladies of the League.
Well, thank you. And I'd like to thank the Gala Pride and Diversity Center and the Diversity Coalition of San Luis Obispo for hosting the candidate forum tonight. The forum is being recorded and will be available on the League of Women Voters website and is being live streamed on the Gala Pride and Diversity Center's Facebook page. My name is Mary Beth Armstrong, and I will be the moderator this evening, and Michelle Call is our host. And of course, I have many colleagues from the League of Women Voters who have contributed to the smooth functioning of this forum. I'm pleased to introduce our San Luis Obispo City Council candidates at this time in alphabetical order. Kelly Evans, Jan Marks, James Papp, Andy Pease, and Robin Wolf. In addition, two other candidates, Jeffrey Sprecht and Aviana Torres, were invited but chose not to attend tonight's forum. And Eric Long lost his Wi-Fi this afternoon and can't join us either. Altogether, there are eight candidates running for two open seats. This evening, each candidate will have 2 minutes for their opening statement and 1.5 minutes to answer questions. Our timer will let the speaker know when they have 30 seconds remaining and when they must stop. Candidates, if you see the stop sign mid-sentence, you may complete that sentence. The order in which the candidates answer questions was chosen with a random number generator ahead of time. And that order rotates throughout the evening. Questions were submitted in advance to the League of Women Voters. We received many excellent questions and will ask as many as time permits. If you, tonight's audience, have questions, please use the Q&A function at the bottom of your screen. If time permits, we'll be able to ask some of those too. Opening statements will be in the following order: Kelly Evans, Robin Wolf, Andy Pease, Jan Marks, and James Papp. Ms. Wolf, you will be second, so you may unmute your microphone now, but please do not speak until Ms. Evans has completed her remarks. Ms. Evans, you may begin your opening statement now.
Thank you so much, Mary, and thank you everyone for having us here tonight. I am running for Slo City Council. My priorities lie not in honing in on one issue to the devaluation of others, but in seeing how they affect each other, working at those intersections for more affordable long-term solutions. Economic recovery, environmental sustainability, and diversity must be at the heart of every piece of policy we put forward right now and into the foreseeable future. The issues we face are not separate, and addressing them as such is inefficient and more expensive than admitting that they're deeply intertwined. I have taken action to the best of my ability in private life as an organizer, helping set up Slow Core, a collective of organizations and relief efforts aimed originally around mutual aid and stepping up where our county government didn't during COVID-19. I have a history of building coalitions across political spectrums to meet the challenges that my community is facing and to make sure that we are fulfilling needs where they're needed. I've interacted with council repeatedly. I have volunteered at shelters and nonprofits across our county. And privately, I work as an event organizer, essentially in creating budgets that fit people's grandest visions and partnering that with reality. I believe that policy should flow from an intersectional framework and understanding that all our issues facing our community are interrelated. Economic recovery from this pandemic will require improvements in housing. Increased housing will create jobs, and sustainable construction is critical to a green, energy-efficient future. Transit policy must be understood through the lens of the working class needs, as well as housing development, and vice versa. Our public health policies must account for crises like the pandemic, but also means re-examining the role of policing and viewing homelessness as the public health and safety issue that it is, for both unhoused and housed citizens. Our city's residents deserve representation that serves them. The folks who don't have the time to attend a midweek evening meeting because they're working, or in class, or putting their kids to bed, they need a representative who understands the life of a tenant, like more than 60% of our population. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Wall?
Thank you, everyone, for your invitation to speak here tonight, and happy Coming Out Day. I am Robin Wolf. I am running for SLO City Council. I was born in SLO and grew up on the beautiful Central Coast here. I did also have the opportunity to spend about 10 years in New York City, living in one of the largest and most diverse cities in our world. It's given me a great perspective on our town of San Luis Obispo, how it's unique, and why we love to live here. I have had the opportunity to share a handful of panels with my fellow candidates that you're seeing here tonight. And I think we have one thing in common, which is we love San Luis Obispo. We share many views and goals and ideals, even if we don't always agree. So I'm going to tell you why I'm different from my candidates tonight, my fellow candidates. I am running for SLO City Council because I don't see people like me on SLO City Council. I'm going to echo what Kelly said. Often the people who are workers and renters on the Central Coast don't have the opportunity to be engaged in civic government. That is why I think that I am a good representation of that group. I am also a 2+ decade member of an industry that has been absolutely devastated by the impact of COVID-19, both health-wise and economically. And that's our forward-facing industries, our public-facing industries, hospitality, tourism, and the service industry. We're a visitor community and a tourist economy. And so many of these public-facing industries are struggling to survive. The businesses play such a major role in why SLO is the city that we love to live in and love to share with visitors. And they employ many, many of our residents who are grappling with job insecurity and decreased income or unemployment. We need representation on our city council that understands how these businesses function and how to offer help that at the city level that is most effective. I have been boots on the ground since day one of this pandemic, adapting business models weekly and daily. This is an umbrella issue, our economic recovery that touches everything else in our lives, our health, our public safety, civil rights, housing, homelessness, our natural health and environment, and climate change. They're all vitally important issues. And as Kelly said, they are all interconnected. Thank you for having me here tonight. I'm here to answer any questions you may have. If we don't have the time tonight, feel free to reach out directly.
I'm very sorry.
Okay.
I want to ask the candidates to each make sure that you have your gallery view on so that you can see when the timer raises the yellow flag and the red flag. Next is Ms. Pease.
Thank you so much. I'm Andy Pease. I've had the honor of serving on City Council since 2016, and I'm running for re-election. I'm an architect and a green building consultant. I have a small firm in town, and my husband and I moved here in 1997 and raised our two daughters here. And my vision for San Luis Obispo is a community that's sustainable, inclusive, and thriving. I have a diverse perspective, a balanced approach, and I listen to all different perspectives. And I'm excited about the work that we've done. I'm proud of what we've done, and I look forward to being able to do more of that work, especially now as we do focus on economic recovery, housing affordability, so that more folks who work in the city can afford to live in the city, addressing homelessness. Of course, climate action is a major focus of mine, and diversity, equity, and inclusion. Happy Coming Out Day, and I'm thrilled to be at this particular forum, and I really appreciate the collaboration of the League of Women Voters and the Gallup Pride and Diversity Center and the Diversity Coalition to bring all those entities together to be able to provide this voice for the community. I think is so important. In terms of that diversity, I think we all share the ideal, but just to make sure to state it out loud that I do support the full and equal inclusion of all members of the LGBTQ community in terms of marriage, employment, health benefits, parental rights, affirmation within their communities, military service, everything. I think that that's such important work. It's not, we have more work to do so that all folks in this community feel healthy, safe, that they belong, that they're empowered. So I believe that that work is really important, of course, and look forward to working with everyone. Thanks.
Thank you. Ms. Marks?
Thank you. And thank you for this opportunity to address these really important issues and discuss them with you, especially on National Coming Out Day. So I'm a friend of the LGBTQ plus community, and you have my full support. During this crisis, COVID-19, many residents are experiencing tremendous stress, but the most vulnerable members of our community, especially those at the intersection of overlapping kinds of discrimination and hate, the stress for them is even worse during COVID. So I'm running for city council because I'm committed to addressing the issues of the underserved and leading the city through this difficult time toward a thriving, sustainable, and inclusive post-pandemic future. I am anti-racist and I'm an ally of the LGBTQ plus community. As an elected official, I have a proven 12-year track record of fighting discrimination and getting good things done for the community. When I discovered that the Boy Scouts, a group openly discriminating against gays and non-believers, had been given space in the community center for decades rent-free, I led the charge to make them move out. Married to a man for over 50 years, I have always supported same-sex marriage and rejoiced with gay friends when it was legalized. As mayor, I was honored to officiate at the marriage of two wonderful men in the gala office. Volunteering at 40 Prado, I have met trans and queer people homeless because they've lost jobs or their families have turned their back on them. I'm deeply concerned about this. So on council, I will fight for diversity, inclusivity, affordable housing, implementing our climate action plan, and police overstate. I would appreciate your vote. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And Mr. Pett.
Hi. I'm known for very long sentences, so I'm not sure if I continue with my sentence when the timer is up, it may go another 5 minutes. Thanks, Mary Beth and League of Women Voters. My earliest memory of a candidate debate is a League of Women Voters debate. And I asked my mother, who are they? So I'm glad that you are still at it and will be forever. We're all here in, also thank you for to Michelle for hosting us in her TARDIS. And there's plenty of room. I don't have prepared remarks because I'm just so, I don't know, moved, shocked. I don't know what I am. I was canvassing today at Ocean Air Mobile Home Park. And the issue there is affordable housing in a very real way. I mean, it's not talked about theoretically as people do on the city council. Actually, if people on the city council don't talk much about affordable housing, they talk about housing. We've forgotten the affordable part. And what planners love to do in a city is plan, and what they love to plan for is urban redevelopment. And urban redevelopment means making everything a lot more bougie, which means getting rid of mobile home parks and putting up expensive condominiums instead. Those condominiums cannot be built affordably. You cannot build affordable housing in California due to construction costs and land costs. So preserving affordable housing, preserving affordable housing, subsidizing affordable housing, prefabricating affordable housing are options, but the notion that our urban development should all be based on getting rid of things we don't like, things we don't want to look at, and replacing it with expensive stuff is nonsense. And we have to move away from that. That is what planners like to do. It's what city councils like to do. Enough is enough. We need to do something for real people out there with real worries and frustrations and fears. Thanks.
Oh, thank you. And our first question this evening, and Ms. Wolf, you will be the first to answer it, is what is your biggest concern for the city of San Luis Obispo?
I'm going to echo what I said in my opening remarks. I think that there are many important issues facing SLO right now, and they're very intersectional. It's hard to take one out of the mix without addressing the others. But that big umbrella issue for me is going to have to be the most timely one. That is our economic and health recovery from the impacts of COVID-19. It's affecting every other thing we're looking at right now. We can see it in our homeless population. We can see it in our small businesses. We can see it in our public health and safety. So I think we're going to have to re-examine everything through that lens of COVID right now and realize that it's not going away anytime soon. I think that we're going to have to be stronger advocates for the safety protocols that we have, mask wearing, social distancing, and taking this pandemic seriously because it's affecting all of our lives in very real ways. It's exacerbating problems that we've been experiencing for years and bringing a lot of things to a crisis point. So for me, that's going to be the top priority. But like I said, it affects almost everything else we're doing. So it's kind of hard to pick one out of the mix. But I think that if we spend our focus on our recovery as a city, we're going to address those issues as well.
Thank you. Ms. Pease?
Thank you so much. And thank you to the fellow candidates for their really spot on remarks about the concerns of the city and what we need to be looking at. I agree, economic recovery is the critical issue of our city because the economy is the flywheel that empowers us to be able to do so much else, right? We need to, as a city, be able to support our businesses who are employing folks and so those folks can be able to access their own purchasing power and being able to afford to live here and support the city and it goes on like that. So how do we support those businesses? Thankfully, the city has been, we've been really good fiscal stewards of the taxpayer monies. And so we have really clamped down on our budget over the past few years and our certain fiscal sustainability within our pension plans, and it puts us in a more secure footing to be able to do the kinds of support like the parklets for our restaurants, like a funded economic development director to work with our SLO businesses, to be able to support our hotels by deferring payments and for a certain amount of time, and supporting our community, being able to provide the kinds of health and public safety services that a city must be able to provide, even if there is an economic crisis.
Thank you. Ms. Marks?
Okay, thank you. Well, I have to agree with what Robin Wolf said. I just want to say, maybe take it a step further. I really believe the city of San Luis Obispo should mandate that everyone who's on the public streets should be wearing masks. Other cities have done that. We have the authority and we're empowered to do that. And we're not doing it. And so what that means is that if people are entering a store or it delegates the responsibility to these different establishments. And actually that is a civic responsibility that the city should mandate mask wearing. I mean, I had to go to the post office today. I was like actually walking in traffic in order to avoid people without masks who were on the sidewalk, okay? So I'm in the senior demographic, which is more vulnerable and more, exposed. So perhaps that's one of the reasons, but we're not going to open the economy unless we get that COVID under control. And so to me, that's the biggest problem is getting the COVID under control in our city. And I have to say that leads to economic recovery. And the other question I have is about the leadership of the city council. We need to have experienced leaders on the city council. It is not a game for beginners. Thank you.
Thank you. And Ms. Marks, will you mute your microphone when you're not on? Thank you. Mr. Papp.
Unmuted and with my timer on. You also need strong leadership on city council, as well as experienced leadership on city council. And yes, obviously COVID is a huge problem, but the problem of COVID comes from the huger problem that we have in San Luis Obispo of bad governance. And the city council had an opportunity in early May to deal with masking, and they decided to kick the can down the road because they said it would require nuance. That's what we pay you for, is nuance. I had to sit in a meeting with a city councilor for an hour who refused to wear her mask in June after the governor mandated it. Look, we do have a mandate of masks in public. It is the governor's mandate and the city refuses to publicize it. So that mandate is there. The city doesn't care. City is talking about public urination, which, by the way, does not spread COVID. So the governance problem is really at the key, and everybody has been going on and on about, oh, how wonderful we have parklets. We've been talking about that for 45 years. That's how we were able to do it instantaneously. We have a slow government with a W, not SLO. We need to have a faster, smarter, and more thoughtful government that really does things that make sense and doesn't just sit around and kick cans where it wants to kick cans.
Thank you. Now, our second question is, do you support Measure G20?
Should I go ahead and answer the first question, Mary?
I am so sorry. I crushed you off before you spoke. Yes, please do.
That's all right. Thank you so much. And I'm going to take kind of a PAP approach to this one. I'd like to ask us to think about what affects our economic recovery, because we know it's not as simple as open up our stores. That's something I think Andy and Robin and I have touched on a couple times. We know that people spend money where they live and not just where they work. And we know people can't afford to be living in SLO, even those who work here. And so if we just open up the economy and we don't make sure that people can afford to live here, we are essentially pushing our dollars out into somebody else's economy. And so we really need to be taking a much broader vision about what economic recovery really means and how that ties into our public health as well. I think regional collaboration is one of the largest issues that covers not just our economic recovery, not just how that affects job creation and housing, but how it also ties into our sustainability. Because say we do survive COVID and we keep having longer and longer wildfire seasons every year and we eventually burn up, it's not going to matter that we made it through this pandemic or that our economy survived. And so making sure that we are collaborating with the rest of the region to get through COVID, to make sure that there are jobs created after Diablo closes, to make sure people can afford to live here and travel here and spend their dollars here, and to make sure that we are combating climate change as dearly as we can, I think is a much more overarching vision of the greatest problem that we're currently facing. Thank you.
Thank you. And again, I apologize. The second question has to do with Measure G20. Do you support it? And if it passes, what would be your priorities for the revenue it would generate? And this question will begin with Ms. Pease.
Thank you. I do support Measure G20. I think it's really critical for our city. It's not it was not taken lightly when the city council introduced this. We had considered it a couple years earlier and felt like the timing wasn't right, that we needed to get our own financial house in order in terms of paying down pensions. But what we did then is took those 3 years to, again, reduce our city budget by almost $9 million. And at the same time, we took a very hard look at all of the programs and policies and plans that we have as a city, and figured out how much it would cost us to be able to implement those. And it's nothing, it's not crazy stuff. It's not like over the top extravagance. It's like, gosh, we, you know, have a plan to update Mission Plaza. We have a plan for fabulous bike infrastructure and transit. We need to be able to have people get across town to be able to unlock the kinds of housing that we need for the workforce, that affordability piece. So we have a lot of projects that need that $21 million a year that the additional revenue, additional 1 cent would enable us to have. So absolutely, it's a great measure. No one loves new taxes, but it's important for the quality of San Luis Obispo and how and what we value as a community.
Thank you. Ms. Marks?
Thank you. Well, yes, I do support Measure G. I also supported the first sales tax measure when we brought it up. I have to say that echoing what Councilmember Pease was saying, that the revenue from the sales tax measure can be used for things like road improvement, bicycle path maintenance, this kind of thing, but also it can be used for wonderful creative things. And I want to say that when the there was a budget priority setting meeting, and a bunch of little skateboarders and their parents showed up and said, "We need a skateboard park." I advocated making that an actual budget goal, and it was. And you know what? That's why we have a skateboard park right now. So it not only enables us to keep up the level of maintenance, and especially also with our open space to acquire more open space, but it also opens a window so that the wonderful creative residents who live here can propose ideas that actually can be funded. So yes, yes on Measure G. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Papp.
I think I'm the only one here who does not support Measure G, and I do it because I am the probably leftiest member here in terms of politics. I'm very lefty loosey in terms of budgets. I'm very righty tighty. And we need to get our own house in order before we start raising taxes, particularly if we raise taxes in a purely regressive way. And sales tax is the most regressive tax, and to say, oh, well, visitors pay it. I don't know who's being talked about when we talk about visitors, because if people in Paso are shopping over here, they're quote unquote visitors. If people here are shopping in Paso, they're quote unquote visitors. We're all one community. So as an illustration, the city of Monterey spends 10% of its annual operating budget on city hall overhead, that city attorney, city manager, HR, all that kind of thing that doesn't directly affect people. We spend 19% in San Luis Obispo. That is unconscionable to then go and say, oh, give us a tax increase so that the city can, council can have fun passing stuff, when we are spending double what other cities are spending on our city hall overhead. So we need to work out those problems before we start spending extra money on goodies.
Thank you. Ms. Evans?
Thank you so much. I absolutely support Measure G. The city has lost over $1.5 million this summer just from not operating our parking costs as a way to try to mitigate some of the pain that our downtown businesses and our residents have felt within COVID. In order to recoup those costs and continue providing the ways that we have, we need something like Measure G to be providing some new form of revenue for the city. There are hopes to use it to start a revolving business loan or grant to help small businesses get off the ground in the future and recover from the economy. We have a multitude of infrastructural projects that we could borrow against it because it is a permanent tax. We have a much larger borrowing limit than we had with previous 7-year taxes, which means that we can do things like really put on the budget, as Jan brought up with the skate park example, we can do a similar thing with the multicultural center that our BIPOC youth have been asking for in order to make this community more welcoming. We can borrow against what Measure G provides us and be showing that we really do support that kind of racial equity. We also, of course, can be focusing more on our bike paths, creating real infrastructural as opposed to just paint on the road. Paint on the road doesn't really protect anyone. And if we want to move towards the car-free, pedestrian, cycled community that we like to say that we do, we need to start putting dollars and actions towards it. Thank you.
Thank you. And finally, Ms. Wolf.
Yes, I am so impressed with all of the answers that my fellow candidates have shared. I am also definitely a full supporter of Measure G. There is a limited number of ways that that a city can bring in revenue. And this is definitely one that, as Kelly mentioned, because it's long term, we can bond against it and take on real large scale projects. It is, you know, to push back against James a little bit, it is, you know, predominantly paid by visitors, whether they are from outside of the city and within the county, or more specifically outside of the county. We are a visitor community, and people enjoy the wonderful things that SLO has to offer, and they leave some of their dollars here, which I think is a fair ask. So as far as what I would do with the money, some excellent suggestions have come up. I think we do need to focus on our small businesses, creating loans, things like that. Public transportation is hugely important. And again, like reexamining everything in our budget with the lens of COVID and what's really important in these specific times.
Thank you. And this next question, Ms. Marks, will begin with you. How would you balance the creation of bicycle paths with parking shortages for neighborhoods?
Okay, well, I'm a bicycle path advocate and have been for many, many years. I think it's really an important, it's not just for bicycles, it's also for people with strollers, people with walkers, and you know, it's pedestrian as well. So I think it's really good. I think the problem comes when the rights of residents on a street in order to access their own homes or have guests park on the street next to their homes is then those rights are then impacted because of the bike path trajectory and the whole, I've forgotten what they're calling it now, but the bike path that goes down Choro and Broad toward Foothill is an example of that. So I'm a supporter of all age alternate transportation. And that means that the rights of people need to be balanced. It's unrealistic to imagine that a quarter of our residents who are 65 and older are going to be riding bicycles every place or even walking every place. So we need all age alternate transportation, and the rights of residents need to be primary, not just a little interest group, but the residents as a whole. So thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Papp?
There, sorry, I hit the wrong button. Okay. And everything disappeared. I've never owned a car. I've always ever bicycled, and I've only ever bicycled in San Luis Obispo. I mean, I've occasionally driven a car that belonged to other people, but that's how I get around. I was really disturbed by the New Times survey that said bicycle infrastructure is the biggest waste of taxpayer money. So that is an example of winning the battles and losing the war for people's hearts. And the city council loves to put, you know, elaborate bicycle projects up, and then it alienates people. And then everybody says, oh, they're not, you know, dredging Laguna Lake because they've spent the money on the Laurel Street bicycle path, which is, you know, nonsense. But by the same token, most of our bicycle paths seem to be elaborate art projects on asphalt with paint. So I would like us to maintain our current paths, to make them better by having them not just painted paths, which simply encourage people to drive closer to bicycles, not farther away. We need raised paths. You know, we do have a very nice bicycle plan, but a lot of it is kind of crazy and doesn't seem to have been designed by people who actually ride on bicycles. So, you know, everybody loves a bicycle path until it hinges upon what they have. You know, there's no inalienable right in under the First Amendment to have your parking, but by the same token, parking is a third rail here. I don't want bicycles to have, I don't want to be vilified as a bicycle rider. So I think we can compromise and reach consensus.
Thank you. Ms. Evans.
So I spent quite a few years up in Davis, California, which is known pretty widely as the bike capital of at least our state, if not the country. And I have to say, if bike paths are an accepted part of the culture and if they're built in such a way that leave room for cars parked on the street, this is just frankly a non-issue. I remember the last time this came up as a real issue, it was because of a member of our community who chose to not build a driveway and therefore had nowhere to put his car once a bike path was placed on the street, which is really the consequences of your own actions coming back. I want to bring this into play too. I know James Papp has mentioned this in the past. There is the plan for another parking structure downtown, which would give us density in parking so that we could have more bike paths on our roads and still have places to put our cars. And that is one of the reasons that it ends up being kind of an eco policy. It also means that we don't have to retrofit our current parking structures with charger stations for EVs. We can build it into one thing and then repurpose those buildings for something else later. And that kind of out of the box creative thinking and ability to explain why things that look like they're car measures are actually environmental measures is a great example of how we can get around needing to have this argument. It's a great example of getting around the idea that bikes and parking are divisive.
Thank you. And Ms. Wolf?
Yeah, it's as a resident of the downtown area of San Luis Obispo, who often has trouble finding parking near her house, this is something that's very important to me personally. I am in huge support of bike lanes. I think that the efforts made to make San Luis Obispo a more bike-friendly and bikeable, walkable community are intentional, and I think it's moving in the right direction. I think we need to also embrace other forms of public transportation that don't include parking downtown and take a look at what that might look like, especially for, as Jan mentioned, our older citizens who may not make the choice to ride a bicycle or have that choice available to them. I think also Kelly mentioned density. Density in parking is important. We do need more parking downtown. Parking structure is going to alleviate some of that. But we also need to look at it's intersectionally tied with our housing issues. We need to look at more density in housing so that we're not, having as many cars that need to park on the street. We also, it was brought up as far as bike lanes sharing the road with motorists. A lot of our streets are very narrow, so I think we need to take a look at how that looks of bringing everyone together and addressing these issues and getting creative.
Okay, thank you. And Ms. Peace.
Thank you so much. It's a great question, a conversation. I think that we are in a really challenging transition for the community. But I agree with my fellow candidates that it doesn't need to be in either or. We're currently putting the last touches on a draft active transportation plan. It's the first time that we're really putting together bike and pedestrian and the connection to transit. And we have a short range transit plan that has more frequency and more stops and those things all working together to make it feasible for even more people to live car free or car light as a household, perhaps one car rather than two. And so I think that we need that investment. I think that we need to infuse adequate funds to fill in a lot of those critical bike gaps, pedestrian gaps, transit kinds of gaps so that people can reduce their need for parking, and that those who and for cars and then the subsequent parking, and that those who truly need to be able to get around with a car because of abilities, job dependency, et cetera, that they can have places to put their cars, ways to move their cars, and then those who don't need that can enjoy being able to bike around and walk, enjoy being car-free, dash your car someplace.
Thank you. This next question, Mr. Papp, will begin with you. What will you do to expedite progress on the much needed Broad Street project that would alleviate the dangerous traffic situation between Orchid Road and South and Santa Barbara Streets?
I have no idea. I'm going to be the rare politician who has, I really don't know what the, I mean, I bicycle that. I was bicycling that today. Orchid Road and which street?
Between Orchid and South and Santa Barbara Streets.
Okay. Yeah, that's a shitty place. Excuse me. That's a word that's okay for Gayla, but it's not okay for, yes, I see Jan shaking or making a face. It is not okay for League of Women Voters. That is a horrible place to bicycle, I happen to know. It's a horrible place to be a pedestrian. And so I will simply say this, every time we create a corridor with cars primarily in mind, it becomes really awful for everybody else. And that's one of the things about suddenly all of my devices are hooting at me, has nothing to do with this. That's one of the things about I was at, down in that area at a CESLA, at a AIA, Andy will remember this, I think she was an organizer of it, American Institute of Architect meeting, talking about how wonderful it was that we've become this wonderful bikeable, walkable town. There were 52 people at that meeting. I was the only one who showed up on a bicycle. When we left, Derek Johnson, our esteemed city manager, insisted that he give me a ride. And I said, no, I don't need a ride. And he said, oh, but you do need a ride. And I said, I've got my friggin' bicycle. If you cannot bicycle on Broad Street at night, what's the point? So I'll end it there.
Okay, well, thank you. Ms. Evans.
Thank you. I believe that our city council has already started discussing implementation of a pedestrian crosswalk in that area, one with lights for the safety of our pedestrians. That, along with real infrastructure that, again, as a couple of us have brought up tonight, isn't just paint on the road, but is true protective measures for our bikers. And then lights is honestly a really basic thing. San Luis Obispo has a almost shocking lack of streetlights, especially for bikers at night. And just lighting is one of the things that not only will make our bikers safe, as James mentioned, at night on Broad Street, but also reduces violent crime by some extent, which is something that we should be considering non-policing options for, given how our summer has gone. And so making sure that we are thinking about, again, how our actions affect each other, what programs we can implement that has more than one outreaching effect, and how to make our dollars stretch as far as they can. And I'm gonna leave you an extra 30 seconds.
Thank you. And Ms. Wolf?
I'm glad I get to follow Kelly on this one because I really appreciate what she said specifically about lighting in San Luis Obispo. This is something that I personally, coming from living 10 years in New York City, no matter the time of night, it was always well lit, and that really helped to cultivate a feeling of safety. Again, living very close to downtown, once you get a block out of the actual downtown area, the lights get very, very sparse. And public safety is definitely an issue we have to deal with. In that particular corridor that we're discussing, I believe, and I think that Andy can talk more about this, but I believe there are steps being taken already. But yeah, even for cars in that area, I was in a pretty intense car accident in that exact area about 2 years ago. It's a confusing area even for vehicles. And I think that Kelly's right in that we need to look at infrastructure that does go beyond paint on the roads, and if we're going to make that, you know, a major bike thoroughfare, we need to take a look at how they're going to interact with vehicles.
Thank you. Ms. Pease?
Thank you so much. It is a really tricky corridor. There is a South Broad Street corridor plan that has medians and crosswalks. It might have even been developed under Jan's watch. It's been a success story in terms of the zoning of housing and a tale of woe in terms of the cost of those kinds of street improvements to be able to get medians in that. It's just a very long drawn out process. Another one of those reasons why we need the kind of funding mechanism like Measure G to be able to implement those bigger projects. There is indeed a pedestrian beacon planned for Woodbridge, and it will be in the 2021 cycle. And as we discussed at our last capital projects update, so that'll help. But it's a very big corridor, very wide. It is tricky for bikes, pedestrians, cars, and I hope that we continue to do those pedestrian beacons while we can, until we can do the kinds of longer term improvements for walkability, aesthetics, and slowing down the car speed. That's one of the biggest issues along that. Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you. And Ms. Marks?
Thank you. Well, I do think we need to look at a basic issue, which is the signals that a driver gets from a highway. And on Broad Street right now, the signal is, you know, metal to the pedal, and this is some kind of a freeway, especially when we have all these people who are trying to get to South County and avoid the freeway. So it's not just local traffic, it's commuter traffic that we're dealing with. So we need to figure out some ways to reduce the impact of the present configuration of that street. And Andy's right that there is a plan in place to basically slow down traffic, like a road diet is what we called it. We did it on South Street, and it works. So basically, traffic needs to slow down there. I want to say that building all that increased housing around that area on Orchid and the Raggedy Ranch area and all that, we really need to address the Broad Street problem as a priority, or we're going to have more unfortunate accidents like Robin's. I have to say also, my daughter used to live on Broad Street. She's moved now, but just getting in and out of her driveway was impossible. And thank you for the crosswalk at Woodbridge. We really need it. So, okay.
Okay. And this next question then, Mr. Pauk, we'll start with you. How many more housing units does the city need to have built to meet its needs, including truly affordable housing?
That's a difficult question because we are not building truly affordable housing. We're not building scarcely any affordable housing. What we're doing is planning to tear down affordable housing. So if we continue to tear down affordable housing, then we'll have to build a lot more affordable housing. The problem is you can't build affordable housing unless you subsidize it. And this is what I spoke about earlier in our Mid-Higera plan, which was passed in 2002, I think when Jan was on the council, anticipates removing all of the mobile home parks from that area and tearing down Brook Street, which planners consider an eyesore because it's old, and replacing that with fancy new condo buildings. The problem is, as I, for instance, look at a very chic condo building on Marsh Street, which again replaced an older affordable building, is that $1 million housing, which I know for a fact all the units have been sold in, I never see the lights on. That is because we are building units for people to inhabit as second homes from San Francisco or Los Angeles. So that throws everything out of the equation. What we need to do is, there's not a specific number, but we need to focus on building the housing that we need, not what developers want. Developers want things that are going to make them a lot of money. That's not what this community needs.
Thank you. Ms. Evans?
Thank you so much. This is a difficult question because our 2020 housing element has not been approved by the state yet, and that's information that we really need to have, especially as incoming council members. Our incumbents obviously have more immediate knowledge about what's really needed because they've been working on that plan for the past several months. We will need to take a good hard look at it, especially when we're creating the budget in January. I would like to disagree with James again very briefly. We know that our developers actually can afford the land here. It is not a cost of land issue in terms of building more. One of the costs that prices a lot of folks out is how long our approval processes take. They take two or three times as long as some cities with more intense, in-depth historical reviews need to happen. We are so lucky to have the Historical Board and the Planning Commission, and we should really be working with them to be streamlining those processes and not pricing folks out of being able to build housing. One of the other things that gets brought up, and not as much as it should, is how low the number of affordable units that we currently insist developers have. It's far, far lower than what we know our need is. And so making sure that whatever that number that needs to be built matches the number of people who have need is going to be where our numbers come from.
Thank you. Ms. Wolf?
I get to follow Kelly again, which is great. Again, I am going to agree with a lot of what she said, but I am going to say that we already have several larger housing developments in the pipeline that are going to give us a lot of single family homes. I think that something we need to look at in regards to slow workforce housing is that not everyone in our workforce community needs single family homes. I think we need to look at more creative uses for existing buildings. I think we need to look at the possibility of rezoning. I think we need to look at mixed use buildings and live work opportunities. And I think that we need to recognize the fact that not every resident of SLO wants a 3-bedroom house with a yard that's 4 miles from downtown. I think we need to address what affordable housing really means, who it's affordable for, and what those people actually really need. Because I think that there is a much more diverse swath of people in SLO looking for housing that doesn't always look the same. So that is my current take on housing.
Thank you. Ms. Pease?
Thank you. And, you know, the kind of the numeric answer, right, is that we have a general plan, that there was a 3-year very public process to develop what our capacity is as a city, and it includes a 1% cap of 1% on average growth rate. And so as a city, we are currently set to go from 47,000 currently to 57,000-ish in 2035. And that has to do with our jobs housing imbalance. We have 30,000 people, you know, pre-COVID, who are commuting into the city every day. And so we are really recognizing that the folks that we want to make sure that we are making housing for is the workforce, the folks who work here so that they can afford to live here. That's a social justice issue. It's an environmental issue. It's an economic issue. And I, you know, James is entirely right in terms of the type of housing is what matters. And I'm proud that the new housing that's going to come on board requires, has a priorities for locals first. It requires owner occupancy, but, and I think we can do more. I think we do need some of that creativity. I think that we need to have ways to talk about and disincentivize kind of that second home type of model so that we can be more sustainable within our housing community.
Thank you. And Ms. Marks?
Thank you. Well, I just want to say, as someone who's a real estate attorney for over 20 years, that the market is what sets the price of housing. Developers will tell you, and they'll try to make city council bend over backwards to cut them all these breaks. But actually, the market is what sets the price of housing. And so what we need is more affordable housing. I believe it's set at 15% of the residential units now. I would like to see that increased. But the other problem is what people are calling the missing middle of young people who, relatively young people, who are not able to qualify for affordable housing because they earn too much, but they don't have enough money to actually buy a house or a condo in San Luis Obispo. So I think that that is really a very important way to go. I want to correct what James Papp said earlier. I'm a big advocate for manufactured and mobile home housing. I think that that is the way to the future. We need to have a lot more. People often start out with a mobile home, then they move up to a condo, then they move up to a home that's perhaps larger, often as their family grows. So we need a lot of diverse housing. There's no particular number except what the state is trying to make us do, which is the regional housing allocation number, the RENA number. And I think we need to assert local control over that as much as possible. Thank you.
Thank you. For this next question, Ms. Evans, you'll go first. Two projects currently in the approval process are Marsh and Choro and Marsh and Napomo, both tall buildings. Do you believe there are too many tall buildings being approved, especially since COVID-19 has shown employers how much can be done by employees at home? Also, what is your plan for tall buildings in the future?
Thank you, Mary. I have been very open about being a fan of height where height is needed. I think there's pretty much consensus among your candidates here tonight that we do not want to sprawl out as a town. We want to be making sure that our green belt is taken care of and protected and available for the wildlife that uses it and available for the people that really enjoy getting to see it. And that requires a little bit of height in order for us to provide for housing. The big housing question that I've gotten quite a lot of is, if we keep building, won't people keep coming? And that's really looking at this from the wrong angle. We need to be providing housing for the people who are already here and can't afford it right now, who are on the streets right now, not by choice, but because they have no other choice. And for all of the many, many people who work and send their kids to school and shop here and can't afford to live in town, but would really like to. Those are the people that we're building housing for. That requires a little bit of height. We have evidence that that does not block our views. We can see our hills from everywhere in town. Trees actually tend to be what block the view most, and we obviously need trees. We also, if we don't build up, will eventually end up sprawling into our green space and even up those mountains, and there is nothing less sustainable than that. I think James's plan of reusing current buildings is a really good one, but we need to make sure that we're also utilizing infill development and creating good use of spaces that are currently sitting empty.
Thank you. Ms. Wolf?
Thank you. I am not anti-tall building. I agree with Kelly in that we need to build up, not out, if we want to protect our open spaces and our green belt, which is part of what makes San Luis Obispo, San Luis Obispo. I think that infill is very important as well, although I think we need to be mindful of what we're doing with that development in order to maintain, you know, the charm of our neighborhoods, which again is something that's very important to all of us. I know that James will speak on preservation, and I'm looking forward to hearing him speak on that. But I do not think that preservation and progress are mutually exclusive. I think that we can keep the charm of downtown San Luis Obispo and our other prominent neighborhoods while still building much needed density and housing for our workforce. I think that building up, not out, creates a more unique, livable work environments and creates a more walkable, shoppable, livable communities, cuts down on parking needs, and is better on our environmental record.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Pease?
Thank you, and I won't speak about the specific projects, but height in general. I think that we are generally a 50 feet and lower kind of town, and that there are on occasion a few locations that are big enough with enough setbacks and that that they can accommodate that higher, the up to 75 feet. So I think there is a role for those kinds of buildings. I certainly don't see them kind of taking over our downtown. I think that we need to update our historic resources inventory. And I certainly won't pretend that I learned that from anybody other than James. But it is critical for the development community to have clarity on what projects we are, what buildings are definitely being kept and which ones are maybe not of the kind of value that we need to sustain. So I do think we need to do that. And I think we need to look beyond our downtown. I think that the Lower Higuera, I think rethinking some of our shopping malls. I think that there are other places to put housing, create walkable neighborhoods. Not that we want to keep our downtown as a neighborhood, as the heart of the city. And I think we can do other ways to put height so that we don't have quite as much development pressure only there, because that really is kind of our only location right now.
Thank you. Ms. Marks?
Thank you. Well, I would be against turning our downtown into something like New York City, that canyonization is what I call it, where there's tall buildings on every side. I think that that would be a real mistake. I've advocated unsuccessfully for years to have a vision for Marsh Street, for example, where there's some beautiful old historic buildings, But other councils in the past have said, oh no, just tear them down. And so we lost the Sinsheimer home and certain other beautiful Victorian buildings that if they were still there would just, you know, really show so much character. But I do have to say that I think having the flexibility of being able to have a tall building where it's appropriate, where it fits in with the historical guidelines and also the community design guidelines, both of which need to be updated, is appropriate. It's very important that we maintain our urban reserve line, that we don't sprawl out, that we don't destroy our green belt. And so we're going to have to accept a certain amount of density in order to do that. So the identity question, is San Luis Obispo a suburban town or is it a little city? I have always come down on the side of the little city. Little city may have to grow up and be a bit taller.
Thank you. And finally, Mr. Papp.
So nobody is going to move off the street into a high rise. That is just a reality. It is a false dichotomy that developers have created to suggest that preservation and housing are somehow opposed, and preservationists are old fogies, and they lie in the path of advancement. One of the smartest things that was ever said in my presence when I was chairing the Cultural Heritage Committee was someone who said in about the project at Palma Napomo, which has since gone into bankruptcy, said, I'm never going to be able to afford to live in this, but I'd like to know someone who does. So the reality is what high-rise buildings in downtown are not for you. They're not for us. They're not for anybody we know. They're not solving homelessness. They are means for developers to make money. The question is, are we killing the goose that lays the golden egg? The goose that lays the golden egg for San Luis Obispo tourism is partly our incredible surroundings. Ken Schwartz realized that in 1969, and it is partly our unparalleled collection of eclectic architecture. We could be, for San Luis Obispo, what Palm Springs is for mid-century modern, or Santa Barbara is for Mission and Spanish Revival. But our city manager and our city development director love to collect the fees from these housing proposals in order to balance the city budget. And that's where the real pressure is, not any systemic or philosophical point of view.
Well, thank you. Unfortunately, we have no more time for questions. But once again, the League of Women Voters would like to thank the Gala Pride and Diversity Center and the Diversity Coalition of San Luis Obispo County for sponsoring this event. And we also want to thank each of the candidates for City Council for your participation. Due to time constraints, unfortunately, we weren't able to ask all the questions that were submitted. But I do thank all the viewers who did submit questions. In closing, I ask that everyone make sure that your voter registration is up to date. All registered voters should have received a mail-in ballot by now. And I ask you to get those ballots in time. There will also be in-person voting, but locations will be limited this year. For more information, I recommend VotersEdge.org, a very useful resource to educate yourself on the candidates and the measures on your ballot. Please vote and encourage your family and friends to vote too. Thank you.
Thank you, Mary Beth, and thank you to our candidates. And thank you all for being willing to step up and run for a position and try and make a change in our town. We really appreciate you doing that. So yes, as Mary Beth said, please go out and vote. We thank you all for your time, and we hope that you have a great rest of the evening.
Thank you so much.